succeed in the task I have set before you, it must be you. The line of succession is clear. When Cadian took the oaths that secured him the Ashayan throne, he was forced to relinquish his claim to Ferel. Thresson is as good as dead. You are next in line. Bolus threatens your claim. He is your enemy. You will kill him and claim your rightful place as king and emperor.
Rezkin said, "You can keep the kingdom. I only want the sword."
Moldovan grinned.
"I am an old man. I have nothing left to lose. I can take the sword with me to the grave. For you, it is all or nothing."
First King of Lonloresh.
"He is what?" said Tyrion, his voice echoing through the warehouse.
"That is the latest news," said Captain Jimson. "Rezkin is the first king of Lonloresh."
"Did he kill the queen?" said Tyrion. Jimson cleared his throat.
"No, your grace. He married her."
Tyrion stared at the captain, his heart racing, his mouth hanging open.
I cannot...
What did you say?
"It is all over Uthrel," said Jimson. "Every sailor, every merchant, every crier and relay worker, they will say the same. Queen Erisiel claimed him as her husband and gave him the Lareshi army and navy."
Tyrion smacked his forehead.
"He is infuriating. He cannot just go and marry the Lareshi queen. What of Kyle? What of Ashai? What of Frisia?"
Well, there is no talk of Frisia, your grace."
"Will you please stop calling me that? That is what people call my father. You may continue to call me Lord Tyrion. No, we have been through enough together. You may call me Tyrion if you prefer."
Jimson shifted.
"Yes, your grace."
Tyrion huffed and kicked a chunk of broken pallet.
"What do titles mean anymore? Everyone has gone insane. No one marries the Lareshi queen!"
He hung his head and then said,
"Is there news of anyone else? Only a bit of talk about a female knight of Kyle. Nothing we do not already know."
An inkling of hope entered his mind.
"Does he recognize the marriage?"
"No one seems to know for sure," said Jimson.
"Well, let us pray to the Maker that he does not."
Beside him, Mage Morghesa said,
"I did not think you were much for praying."
Tyrion said,
"If anyone can force a prayer, it is my cousin. Where is he now?"
"That is also a mystery," said Jimson.
Tyrion growled.
"We need a relay. This is archaic. Our news is weeks old at best."
He turned to Mage Morghesa.
"Are you sure that none of you has the requisite knowledge or power to create one?"
She gave him a disparaging look.
"Lord Tyrion, we have discussed this 12 times. King Rezkin brought the supplies from Sarret, but none of us knows how to construct one. Since he knew what items were necessary, he is our best bet."
Tyrion ran his hands down his face.
"If he knows, then why did he not build it?"
"Well, because he is not a mage," she said.
This time he gave her the dubious look. She raised her hands and said,
"I'm only telling you what he told me."
Tyrion noticed an anxious young man hovering a few paces behind the mage. He recognized the young man as one of Frisia's assistants, but he could not remember his name.
"You, what do you want?"
The assistant bowed low, then said,
"Your Grace, Trademaster Moyle requests your signature on the final proposals for the Applin wine deal with the Merchants Guild in Uthril."
Tyrion sighed and waved a hand at the young assistant as he looked at Jimson.
"See? Frisia was supposed to be taking care of this. It was her idea, and she is more adept in trade regulations than she claims."
His voice rose as his frustration mounted.
"But she ran off to be with Rezkin, and he married the Lareshi queen!"
A woman was suddenly at his other side. He had not seen her approach.
"Your Grace," said Lady Gatterand, "I'm quite good with trade. I've run my house's affairs for some time since my dear husband passed away. I would be happy to assist."
Tyrion smiled, but he felt no relief in her offer.
"Thank you, Lady Gatterand, but that is not necessary. I will handle it."
The woman barely flinched from the rejection, which only made him more suspicious. She said,
"It is most considerate of you to see to these matters, which are far below your station in Lady Frisia's stead. It did surprise me when I heard she had gone after him. I mean,
She had expressed her concerns.
You spoke with her, said Tyrion.
Oh, yes, at length. She was very upset and confused. I tried to offer counsel, but she would not be reasoned with. I cannot imagine what might have made her think to follow him.
She smiled anxiously as she glanced at the others.
Oh, I apologize. My concern for Lady Frisher overtook my sense for a moment. I should not speak of such things in public. Please do keep me in mind if you decide you have more important matters to which you must attend.
Before Tyrion could respond, she said,
Did I hear you say that King Rhaeskin is wed?
Tam dozed with his back pressed against the hull. Scant light streamed in from the gaps in the planks above, so he could not see the men and women who shared his fate. He could smell them, though. He and probably everyone else had long since given up on dignity. There were no privy breaks. Once a day they were forced to muck their own filth and carry it up to the deck where it was thrown overboard. In the weeks or months he had been on the ship, he had considered following the waste into the sea on several occasions. Others had apparently had the same idea, though, and after the first few jumped, the slavers started chaining them in pairs. Apparently it was much harder to convince a stranger to end his life at the same time as you. While they were below deck, the chain that linked him to his partner by shackles around their necks was fed through a loop on the hull. It was impossible to lie down. But they realized that if one of them stood, the other could lean forward enough to hold his head in his hands while resting his elbows on his knees. The major disadvantage was that if the man standing over fell or passed out, the other would be yanked rather hard by the throat. One man had actually died from a crushed airway, and Tam had chided himself for his envy. In truth, he did not want to die. Only he was not sure he could stand living any longer. His head throbbed almost constantly, and he suffered from several nosebleeds per day. He noticed, though, that when he sat in the dark, with no distractions, his mind settled to give him enough relief to feel his hunger and thirst. Still, he knew that without the help of the healers that he had been promised, he was doomed to a painful demise.
I think we've stopped, said his partner, Ute.
Ute had been a mercenary from Gendishan. His company had been wiped out by Droglics, and the slavers had discovered him unconscious on the side of the road. They had decided to capitalize on the find. Tam roused from his half-dream state.
Stopped.
The hull struck something. The ship rocked, and then it struck again.
That sounds like a dock, said Ute.
Since Ute was now sitting up, Tam could sit on the bench.
I'm filled with both dread and relief. Where do you think they took us? Couldn't say. I lost track of the days. Maybe the Isle of Sand? It'll be harder to escape from an island, said Tam.
Ute chuckled.
You think to escape? You'll be dead before you take three steps as a free man. I'm not without skills, and neither are they. If you decide to escape, do it when I'm not tied to your neck.
Tam coughed, feeling a tickle at the back of his throat that he knew was blood, since he didn't have enough saliva to wet his tongue. He croaked,
You can die a slave if you want, but someone will come for me. Who? Who will come for you? These men take people no one will miss. If they took you, it's because you were alone. I was alone for a reason. My people will come for me. Even if they do, they'll not find you. It's not as if the slavers record names and log where you go. If anyone has the will to track you down, the slavers will know your value. Your friends will have to pay a fortune to get you back. I doubt you're worth it.
Tam tried to lick the salt from his lips, but his dry tongue only scraped against the cracks. He said,
I'm not you. No, you are delusional. At least I accept my fate. I could have been torn apart by those lizard monsters, but instead I'll die at the hands of men. They are monsters too, said Tam. True, but they're monsters with the keys, said Ute with a shake of his chains.
The grate over their heads was pulled back and a dark silhouette blocked the sun.
You're coming out now, said the man over their heads.
Give us any trouble
and we'll make sure you don't die quickly.
Monsters, Tam muttered. Isaria blinked as the wind whipped across her face. She looked up at the overcast sky, sighed heavily, and then met the woman's gaze.
No. But he is a good man, and he speaks Ashayan. You see, I have taught him. He even has a touch of the talent.
I have no desire to claim your son, Matrianera Wulshina.
Wulshina clasped her hands before her.
I have saved for this day. I will make you a generous offer.
Malcius said. Is she offering to pay you to claim her son? Isaria scowled at him.
It is a dowry.
The woman nodded as she pointed to a young man hovering at the edge of the encampment.
He is handsome and strong.
Isaria could not deny the truth of the woman's words. The man was tall, with broad shoulders that supported a well-defined upper body, but he kept his hands in his pockets as he hung his head, only glancing at them occasionally. Looking back at the woman, Isaria said,
Why is he over there? Does he not wish to be claimed?
The woman fervently shook her head.
Oh, no. He likes you very much. He is shy. He has difficulty meeting new people, especially a Matria of your standing. Or is it Matrianera?
Isaria crossed her arms.
It is neither. I am a knight of Kyle, and I have no intention of claiming anyone.
The woman glanced at Malcius.
But did you not challenge the echelon for this one?
Isaria pursed her lips.
Yes, but only because she forced my hand.
Thanks for that, Malcius muttered. You were perfectly willing to claim Pallas. Isaria rounded on him.
Pallas was worth claiming!
Malcius clamped his mouth shut, glanced at the Matrianera, then stalked off toward the tent. Isaria's blood was boiling. She was angry, but not at Malcius. She should not have been so rude to him. She knew he was mourning Pallas more than she, but he had been haranguing her ever since Pallas's death, and she was tired of the incessant guilt. Wulshina hesitantly said,
This Pallas is another consort?
As she watched Malcius's retreating form, Isaria replied,
Pallas was his brother. He died protecting me.
Wulshina glanced at her son. She bit her lip and said,
If you become Echelon, will you stay?
No. I serve the king as a member of his royal guard. I go where he goes.
Then you will need more protection and someone to keep your house.
The woman nodded in the direction Malcius had gone.
I do not think he will do this for you.
I am capable of taking care of myself, said Isaria.
The woman smiled.
I am sure you are, but everyone needs support.
She moved a little closer and lowered her voice.
My son, he is strong and a hard worker, but he is not aggressive. He is not a fighter. This is why I think you will be a good match. You do not need a fighter.
Her gaze flicked to the other people, who stared out of curiosity but were respectful enough to keep their distance during negotiations.
If he stays here, someone will wish to claim him for champion. He will lose and he will get killed. Please, I know you are at war, but he will be safer with you than he will be here.
Isaria schooled her features out of respect for the mother's plight.
I am sorry for your troubles, but I will not be guilted into making a claim. This is the fourth time someone has approached me with such a request.
With another pensive glance toward her son, Wulshina said,
I will release him to serve in your household. You need not claim him. Just take him with you.
She subtly crossed her wrists in front of her, a pleading gesture.
Please, I will give you his dowry for his care. He will work hard and earn the rest.
Isaria frowned and pointed at the man, causing him to glance her way. Their gazes met, and he immediately dropped his head. She said to Wulshina,
As he said, he is a handsome, strong man. He could easily be claimed as consort in a number of houses, even if only to breed and care for the young. Why would he wish to become a servant?
Of course he would prefer to be claimed,
she said.
But he would rather become a servant than a champion. Three Matrias have already made offers. All three believe he can be trained for combat. He dreads the thought. I beseech you. I know he is only a son, but I love him as if he were my daughter. I wish for him to be happy.
Again, Isaria looked at the shy young man with golden hair and tanned skin stretched over taut muscle.
A servant?
Yes, a servant,
the woman said hopefully.
What is his name?
His name is Jappa. He is 26 years old, and he has been formally educated. His skills are in farming and irrigation. He does not have enough talent to be a full mage, but his affinities are for water and earth.
Isaria sighed.
Very well. If I win my challenge, I will take Jappa as a servant only.
Tears welled in Wolshina's eyes, but Isaria could not tell if they were born of joy or sorrow. The woman grabbed her hands and said,
Thank you. You will not regret this night, Isaria. Would you like to meet him?
Isaria glanced at Jappa.
Not now. I must remain focused. Should I win the challenge, there will be plenty of time later. Besides, I think you will need time to convince your son.
Oh yes, but he will be pleased.
The woman crossed her arms and pressed her forehead to her wrists as she backed away.
We will come to you after your victory. Thank you again.
Isaria turned to the tent she begrudgingly shared with Malsius. Ironically, she had fought to keep him with her. The Echelon had tried to make him join her party, but Isaria had insisted he stay with her until the challenge was resolved. The Echelon acquiesced, and Isaria wondered if the woman regretted making the claim in the first place. The woman could no longer back out, though, without giving up her seat as Echelon. As she entered the tent, Malsius said,
Well, do you have another consort? Are you collecting men now, like the rest of these Lurishis?
Isaria lifted her chin.
We have come to an arrangement.
Seriously? You're going to buy that woman's son to what? Be your plaything?
Lord Malsius!
Her indignation felt less feigned than she had anticipated. In a haughty tone, she said,
That is completely inappropriate. Where is your decorum? Since you are as close to family as I have here, I would expect you to defend my honor rather than besmirch it.
Malsius straightened, as if remembering himself.
You are right. That was uncalled for. I apologize.
Isaria gave him a cross nod, then smirked.
Jappa is to become my servant, not my consort.
She looked at him sweetly and batted her lashes.
Only you have that privilege.
Malsius clenched his jaw and said,
I hate this place. You are supposed to meet this challenge tomorrow. Have they told you what it will be? Are they not required to give you time to prepare?
Isaria's smile fell as her anxiety surged. Her blood soured, her muscles tensed, and her stomach churned.
It is to be a battle.
Malsius frowned.
What kind of battle?
A real battle, Isaria said. We are in the third Echelon. The fourth Echelon is led by Orina Goldrin, who had already challenged Echelon Dashari for the marshland along the border. Echelon Orina has agreed to split her forces and attack from two equivalent positions. Echelon Dashari's champion will lead his forces against one, and I will lead mine against the other. The winner will be whichever of us is successful in defeating Echelon Orina's forces, or whichever takes fewer losses, if that be the case.
Malsius looked at her in disbelief.
That is absurd. Echelon Orina is Echelon Deshari's enemy. Why would she agree to that?
Isaria was surprised by his reaction.
Because it is a challenge. Actually, it is three challenges being resolved at once. The Echelons offer battle. It keeps their troops strong and experienced. They do not go to battle for the sake of destroying each other's forces, but to determine a winner.
You are to fight with weapons, he said, and people will be killed?
Yes, of course. It is a battle.
He threw himself into a rickety folding chair that threatened to collapse with the force.
Who are your warriors? He said.
That is the difficult part,
Isaria replied.
For this kind of challenge, I would be expected to bring my own forces. Since I have none, the Echelon has agreed to allow volunteers to fight with me. It is in her best interest that both battles are won, after all. I think it is safe to say that the best fighters will back her champion. She has chosen a different champion to lead the charge. His name is Iphigen. He served in the Queen's Royal Guard before Echelon Dashari claimed him. He has led several successful campaigns against the other Echelons since he joined her.
Malsius threw up his hands.
Great! How is this better than the archery competition?
Because this one does not depend on my skill alone.
She dropped her gaze.
I could not have won the other challenge.
Taking a deep breath, she hardened her resolve and looked at him.
I have never led a battle, but I am a Knight of Kyle and a King's Royal Guardsman. I have been training with Reskin and the Strikers for months. I can do this. I just need the people.
Malsius shook his head in defeat.
Where is my sword? You may use one of mine, said a gruff voice from the tent's entrance.
Malsius and Isaria both turned to see the intruder. He looked to be in his late 40s and was quite fit, despite his limp.
I am Balan, he said. I am Ulshina's champion.
He raised his hand, and two younger men stepped into the entrance.
These are my sons with my former Matria. They are Vanin and Nolus. We have all fought in many battles, and we will fight with you if you will have us.
Isaria grinned at Malsius. She turned to the men and said,
Please enter. I would be honored to have your assistance. I'm surprised by your offer, though. I was not exactly accommodating with Joppa.
On the contrary, said Balan, we are most appreciative of your acceptance. Joppa is a gentleman in a warrior's body. To take a life would break him. He will be happy in service to you. I can tell that you are compassionate.
He nodded toward Malsius.
It is obvious you do not want this one, but you will personally go to battle to keep him from the echelon, because he is your fallen consort's kin.
He glanced back at his sons.
The Matrias do not often recognize this, but the men of Lonaresh honor our bonds. We have spread word of your motives for challenging the echelon. You will not go into battle alone.
Chapter 16 Reskin peered at his prey from atop the parapet in the shadow of the building. Bolas was a doorman with short, cropped black hair and a thin mustache across his upper lip. He wore a bright red suit with yellow frills about the neck and wrists, and his fingers, heavy with golden rings, anxiously gripped a wide-brimmed red hat bearing a large yellow plume. The saber at his hip was sheathed in a gilded scabbard, and he carried a small belt knife encrusted with gemstones. From his shoulders swayed a short red cape trimmed in gold, and his black, knee-high boots were polished to a shine. Reskin had been following Bolas for more than a day, and the man had yet to do anything of interest. He had no more reason to kill Bolas than the rantings of an addled old man who was convinced that Bolas had been responsible for his grandson's death. The only truth he had found in the king's claim was in Bolas's money problems. Bolas was, at that moment, in the bailey cheering a sparring match between two soldiers who looked no better than street ruffians. Every bet Bolas had placed had been a losing one, and Reskin knew this one would be no different. Since Bolas was a betting man, Reskin wondered if he could entice him into a duel to the death. At least then he would have an excuse to kill the man. More than anything, Reskin was frustrated with the disquieting sensation of indecision. Killing Bolas was a means to an end. He should not have needed any more excuse than that. The Strikers who had trained him at the fortress would have applauded the plan, but the Strikers who currently served him would say it lacked honor. Others of his ilk would have no problem with the task. The Jengri would likely shank Bolas in passing, while the Adonaro would use poison or slit his throat in his sleep. With the boisterous crowd, Reskin could easily have killed the man at any time, yet he waited. He waited for an excuse. He wondered if he could let the man live, perhaps extract an oath of fealty from him, but it would be against the rules to allow an enemy to remain at his back. Reskin was also frustrated with Moldovan. If any other monarch were to visit Pharrell, he would not be expected to run about doing Moldovan's errands. To Moldovan, though, this was a test to see if Reskin was worthy of the crown. Reskin did not want the crown, though, and he did not serve Moldovan. So he waited, trying to come up with a better plan. Perhaps he could find the sword on his own. Perhaps he would forget the sword altogether. Only one man stood between him and Kyle. Was that man Bolas or Moldovan? Perhaps he should kill them both. His gaze caught the familiar blonde head weaving through the crowd. Behind it was a darker one, followed by another. Reskin scanned the perimeter and finally found what he sought. He slinked from the shadows back into the castle. He stalked through the corridor in the new boots and princely garb Moldovan had insisted he wear for that evening's event. It was a sleek black affair with silver buttons and a gold and silver baldric. The short black cape had a silver lining, and the Esyojo family crest of two battling vurals, one silver and one gold, adorned his chest. The silver and gold saber at his hip belonged to Moldovan. Rezkin rounded a corner, and two guards at the other end of the corridor shouted to two others in an opposite direction before running to intercept him. As they neared him, they slowed and then came to a stop with a bow. Commander Tynan said,
"Your Highness, we respectfully request that you stay with your consort at all times. It is our duty to protect you."
Rezkin did not pause as he continued walking. He said,
"How can you protect me if you cannot keep up with me?" "If you will stay with us, we will be more than capable," said Tynan.
"So I should restrict my movements because of your inferior training?"
"I assure you, Your Highness, our training is superior to that of any other kingdom."
Rezkin entered an empty office on his right. The two guards followed him, in addition to two more who had joined them. He turned and looked at the commander of his little entourage, but said nothing. Tynan waited, but his confusion became increasingly evident under Rezkin's icy stare. After several minutes, Rezkin said,
"Yours is superior."
"Yes, Your Highness."
Rezkin stepped over to the doorway, reached into the corridor, and grabbed the woman passing by, placing a hand over her mouth to prevent her from screaming. He held her squirming form tightly as he looked at the guardsman. Then, he nodded toward the doorway.
"If your training is superior to that of any other kingdom, then defeat him."
As Rezkin finished speaking, a man entered the room in a rush. Just before the man met the guards, Rezkin said,
"Do not kill them."
The man looked at him, and then the guards were upon him. The woman suddenly stopped squirming as she peered up at him. Rezkin removed his hand from her mouth, but kept hold of her.
Your Majesty?
She said. "Greetings, Mage Threl," he replied. Coladon and Brant hurried into the room on Farson's heels, but stopped when they spied Rezkin, who nodded for them to stay back. Then, all four of them watched as Farson battled the four royal guardsmen. The room was too small and heavily furnished to draw swords, and Farson quickly divested the men of their knives. The commander put up a good fight, better than Rezkin would have expected. Farson was breathing heavily and had a bloodied lip by the time he put the last one down. Two of the guards were unconscious, a third was wrapped tightly in the drapery, and Commander Tynan stared up at them from the floor where he lay at the tip of Farson's dagger. Farson looked at Rezkin and said,
"Was that really necessary?"
Rezkin shrugged. "They needed a lesson, and you needed the exercise. You are getting slow."
"I think he's getting old," said Brant.
Farson's look promised Brant retribution during their next training session. He gave the commander on the floor a warning glare, then straightened and sheathed his knife.
"Perhaps I'm only pretending to throw you off guard."
"That is absurd," said Rezkin. "You could be infirm and on your deathbed, and I would not drop my guard."
Farson pointed at Tynan, who was glancing between them, waiting for permission to rise.
"What did these men do to deserve a lesson?"
Rezkin said, "They thought they had superior training."
Farson shook his head, and then stared at Rezkin's head.
"What is it?" said Rezkin.
"You are wearing a crown."
He nodded. "Moldovan insisted. I am to attend court 20 minutes ago."
"Moldovan does not hold court," said Farson.
"He does today."
Farson glanced at Mage Threl.
"Are you going to release her or hold her all night?"
Rezkin released the mage, who spun to look at him. She said,
"It looks good on you."
"The crown?"
"All of it,"
she said, her cheeks turning pink. Coladon looked at him quizzically.
"Why did you grab her?"
Rezkin nodded at Farson.
"It was the easiest way to get him to reveal himself."
Then he looked down at the commander.
"You may rise. Four of you could not defeat one of him, yet you think to protect me."
Tynan's Ashayan was decent, but heavily accented as he spoke.
"It does not seem that you need protection from him."
"He is your man,"
Rezkin shrugged and said.
"He would kill me if he could."
"Not that you would stay dead,"
grumbled Farson. Mage Threl looked at her uncle with disapproval, and then cast a spell to wick the blood from his face. Rezkin turned to Tynan, who was eyeing them all warily.
"Gather your men."
He glanced at the unconscious guards. "If you can.
We should probably report to the throne room. Baulis will have lost his bet by now and should be there, unless he decided to cast another. As Tynan moved to unravel the conscious guardsman, Mage Threl said,
Who is Baulis, and why are we going to the throne room?
Baulis is the king's nephew, said Rezkin, and I was supposed to kill him.
You failed to kill a target, said Farson with surprise.
Are you sure you were not struck on the head? Replied Rezkin. Of course I did not fail to kill him. I only failed to see why I should.
Rezkin then strode through the doorway and headed toward the throne room.
Farson caught up to him. This was a request from Moldovan?
Yes, in exchange for the sword.
Farson narrowed his eyes and said,
What is your reason for not killing him?
That is a good point, Rezkin said,
but Farson continued to stare at him. Finally, he added,
You would not approve.
Since when do you care about my approval?
Not just you. All of you. My people.
Outworlders require a better reason to kill someone than convenience.
Farson said,
So, you are bound by the opinions of others?
It is my role as king. Kings should be bound by the will of the people.
Few kings feel that way, said Farson. What if a king must make a difficult decision for the good of his people?
Then the king must be willing to suffer the consequences of that decision. This is not one of those times. It is too public. I will not allow Moldovan to seed doubt among my people for his personal vendetta.
Farson did not have time to respond as they filed into the receiving room outside the throne room. The king's seneschal, who had been overly flustered as he paced about the room, urged the guards to open the door promptly. Without another word, Rezkin strode into the throne room. Farson, Mage Threl, Brant, and Coledon slipped around the side to stand at the edge of the somber crowd, while Rezkin strode to the top of the dais and stood beside the throne.
You are late,
grumbled Moldovan after erecting a sound ward.
I arrived before Baulis, therefore I am early.
He was supposed to be dead, Moldovan hissed.
Perhaps you should take that up with your gods, said Rezkin.
I expect you to follow through.
We shall see.
I do not serve you, Moldovan. I will determine if Baulis dies by my hand.
Rezkin gazed across the sea of anxious and even frightened faces. Their flamboyant dress was in stark contrast to the nightmarish room. The women wore colorful, ruffled, high-collared dresses with sleeves that fell to their wrists and skirts that brushed the floor. The men were dressed in much the same manner as Baulis, and everyone wore large hats, making it difficult for anyone behind the front row to see what was happening. For this reason, the people stood on wooden risers that had been installed along the sides of the hall. Baulis was not there. After another uncomfortable wait, he finally strode through the far door to the throne room. Upon entering, he appeared genuinely surprised. He peered at the gathered people and then grinned broadly as he nodded toward the spectators while proceeding toward the dais. Upon arrival, he bowed appropriately toward Moldovan and then noticed Rezkin. He appeared perplexed, but returned his attention to the king.
Your Majesty, I heed your summons.
You are late, Baulis, barked the king.
I apologize, good king. I was delayed by urgent business.
Yes, I am aware of your urgent business in the bailey. I see you still have your shirt. Is it all you have left of your family's fortune?
Baulis's face turned scarlet to match his suit, but he refused to look at the chattering onlookers. Moldovan said,
If you were not so oblivious, you would have realized that you were not the only one summoned.
The king stood and looked over his subjects. He lifted his scepter and tapped it on the ground. Then he said,
Today I abdicate the throne.
He paused to allow the commotion to die, and Bolus's expression brightened. Moldovan held a hand toward Rezkin and said,
This is King Rezkin of Kael, true king of Ishai, first king of Lon Laresh, ruler of the Cimmerian Empire.
The room was completely silent. Not a creak or shuffle as everyone stared at Rezkin. Moldovan met Baulis's startled gaze and said,
He is the legitimate son of King Bordrin of Ishai and Princess Lesilia Esiojo of Ferel. He is my grandson. By right of succession, I name him King Rezkin of Ferel.
Moldovan took his seat as the crowd erupted in a roar of support and disapproval. Bolas stepped forward and shouted,
"Fraud! The king has lost his mind to age, and this impostor seeks to usurp the throne! There were only two princes of Ashai, and he is neither!"
Rizkin noted that there were more cheers in support of Bolas's position than rejections. Moldovan said,
"Did you not hear me? A prince of Ferel is emperor of three other kingdoms. Ace Yojo blood, Fereli blood, rules the Soelian."
This time, many of Bolas's former supporters nodded and cheered the king. One man called out,
"Long live the Fereli emperor!"
And many others took up his cry. Bolas shouted,
"Do you not think I was prepared for this, uncle? I knew you would find a way to cheat me of my crown. I will not let this charlatan steal what is rightfully mine."
He jerked his arm toward the open doorway, and a man sprinted from the hall into the corridor. A moment later, heavy footfalls and clinking armor could be heard growing louder. The royal guardsmen surrounded Moldovan and Rezkin, several imploring the king to seek safety. Soldiers began filling the throne room at the far end, while more of Moldovan's guards filed in from the corridors on either side of the dais, trapping the panicking courtiers between the two forces. Rezkin turned to Moldovan.
"Where is the sword?" "You think I will tell you now? You will take it and run. It will be difficult to find if you die in this mess you instigated."
Moldovan grinned at him.
"Then I had best not die."
After Tynan gave his approval, Rezkin's companions pushed their way past the royal guards. Rezkin drew Moldovan's sword and tossed it to Kolodon, which seemed to confuse the man since he was already armed. Rezkin had prepared for Bolas' refusal to accept the king's decision by stashing his belongings where they would be more accessible. He reached behind the tapestry that hung at the back of the throne and withdrew his black blade. Then he donned the mask of dark tidings and waded through the guards, descending the steps to stand at the center of the throne room. In the eerie voice of dark tidings, he said,
"I will destroy all who stand against me. I am the storm before the calm, and in that calm is death."
Bolas drew his saber but began backing toward the soldiers as he shouted,
"Kill him!"
Rezkin looked over his shoulder to Farson.
"They were warned."
Then he met the charge. With every strike, green lightning crackled within the blade. After the first few fell, Rezkin had to pursue his targets, since few stepped forward to meet him. The others were engaged with the king's guard, and armed spectators fought on both sides. A low, two-handed swipe took off one soldier's legs below the knees. Rezkin took the man's head as he fell and kicked it into the face of another just before he stabbed the man through the gut. Then two soldiers tried attacking at once. Rezkin ducked the swipe at his head and jumped over the one at his legs. He twisted his body as he landed a kick to one of the men in the head, so hard the man's neck snapped. At the same time, he drew his belt knife and stabbed the second in the kidney. Then he twisted back to bury the black blade in the man's chest. Dark red blood burbled from the man's lips to spill over the crackling green lightning. Rezkin kicked the man off the blade, turning just in time to miss a mage attack. Tiny sparkles of light slammed into the body of the falling soldier. The sparkles dug into the man's skin and then exploded, causing bloody flesh to splatter all over Rezkin. He turned, seeking the mage who had launched the attack, and found Bolas preparing another. Rezkin drew two throwing stars from his coat. Bolas lost his spell as he was forced to deflect the stars. His next spell was sloppy, and he accidentally took the arm of one of his own men in the casting. Rezkin stepped toward Bolas, but was stopped short when a thin stream of fire shot past him to take out two of the soldiers beyond. He glanced over to see Mage Threl give him an apologetic smile. He lobbed another star in her direction. Her eyes widened as the star spun toward her, and then it lodged in the eye of the man behind her. He screamed as he grabbed for the star, slicing his hand in the process. Mage Threl turned, thrusting her hand toward him, emitting a blast of power that knocked him off his feet. Bolas sent another swarm of sparkling explosives in Rezkin's direction. Rezkin ducked as he raised the black blade, swatting several out of the way while he snatched a few others out of the air. He looked down at his hand, where he held the insubstantial sparks. He could see the tiny spells squirming within them, trying to get out. It was as if they were alive. Bolas screamed,
"You cannot do that! No, it is impossible! What are you?"
He pointed at Rezkin and shouted,
"Demon!"
It was not the first time someone had called him that, and he doubted it would be the last, but Rezkin figured he would know if he were a demon. Rezkin threw the sparks back at Bolas, who erected a hasty shield. A soldier threw himself in front of the would-be king, and Rezkin could not imagine how the man had garnered that kind of dedication from anyone. Luckily for the soldier, Bolas's spell was not as effective against armor, and the man was left with only a small, gaping hole in one cheek. Rezkin moved to advance on Bolas, but the man continued to back away behind his soldiers. Rezkin forced his way through, cutting down anyone who stood in his way, just as he had promised. When he reached the throne room doorway, Rezkin peered into the corridor. More soldiers lined the way. Brandt stepped up to his side.
"Are they with us or against us?"
"I do not know. They may not know."
Dark Tidings' eerie voice echoed through the corridor.
"All who stand in my way will die."
The soldiers stared at him, and then the closest turned their gazes to the floor. Rezkin looked down to see that his clothes were dripping with blood into a crimson pool at his feet, and bloody footsteps marked his passage. The black blade continuously crackled with green lightning, and pieces of flesh clung to his form.
"Demon!"
shouted Bolas from the other end of the corridor. The soldiers looked back at Rezkin and hardened their resolve. Then they attacked. Rezkin waded through them, followed by Brandt, then Farson, Mage Threl, and Kolodon, as well as several of the royal guardsmen. Together, they slaughtered every soldier in the corridor. Rezkin led the way through the tower that Bolas had entered. They ran up the stairwell, Rezkin sensing for the use of the talent at every landing. Always, Bolas seemed to be above him, so they kept going. Rezkin was the first through the doorway when they reached the top, and he was immediately inundated by a cloud of explosive sparks. He pulled the short cape from his shoulders and used it to sweep the sparks from the air so they would not strike his companions. He balled the cape around the sparks, hoping that his own will was enough to prevent them from exploding. Bolas had begun to light the signal fire that stood in the center of the platform. Rezkin reached past Farson to Mage Threl. He pulled her from the stairwell onto the platform, then pushed her toward the signal fire as he searched for Bolas on the other side. Mage Threl began a spell that caused a fog to form around the signal fire. The fog slowly condensed into rain, and Rezkin was impressed that she had made an actual cloud. His thoughts on the potential uses for a cloud were interrupted by Bolas's scream.
"You're too late! I will not let you have my birthright! The throne is mine!"
Bolas held in his hands a small clay pot marked with arcane runes. He placed the vessel on the ground and pulled the stopper as he began to recite an incantation. Black fumes spewed from the open container, crawling up his legs.
"Igak shewe kruikina!"
The incantation was curtailed when a dagger sprouted from Bolas's throat. A horrid screech emanated from the black fumes as they shriveled into themselves. A burst of power knocked everyone on the platform from their feet when the vessel suddenly exploded. Rezkin pulled himself from the ground and checked that the others were well before approaching Bolas. The man was dead, of course, but Rezkin was always cautious when approaching dead men. After pulling his knife from the man's throat, he gathered the pieces of the clay pot for later examination. He grabbed Bolas by the ankle and dragged him across the platform to the stairwell. The royal guards offered to take the body, but Rezkin refused. He dragged the man the entire way down the tower, and then through the corridor toward the throne room. Moldovan had remained on his throne, while the courtiers who were not permitted to leave cowered between the drainage grooves that were carrying blood and body fluids toward the drainage gutters along the walls. Stepping over corpses and splashing through puddles, Rezkin made his way back to the dais where he dropped the body that had been battered nearly beyond recognition.
"Bolas is dead. Give me the sword."
Moldovan said,
"This could all have been avoided if you had killed him in the first place."
Rezkin removed his mask and waved around the room. This was the voice of your people. The dissenters are dead or cower in fear. Esyojo rule is secured. Moldovan grinned. This is why you will rule an empire. He stood and picked up his scepter in his gnarled fingers. You are an emperor, so I will not ask you to kneel. You do not ask me to kneel because you know I will not. The king chuckled. He pulled an amulet from beneath his robe. It had a large garnet set in the center with tapered spirals of gold at the top and bottom. He tapped the scepter to the amulet. He said, Duyana Espikel Umbalai. He tapped the scepter to Rezkin's right shoulder, then his left. Finally, Moldovan pressed it to Rezkin's forehead and repeated the incantation. Duyana Espikel Umbalai. The garnet in the amulet began to glow a deep red, as did the scepter. He handed the scepter to Rezkin, then removed the amulet and placed it over Rezkin's head. He said, Speak the ancient words. Rezkin considered not saying the words, but after all his troubles, he was not going to walk away without the sword. He glanced at Farson and then said, Duyana Espikel Umbalai. The scepter glowed brighter, then dimmed as the stone's light grew intense. Finally, the light in both died. Somehow, Moldovan looked older after it was finished. The color had faded from his flesh, and his gaze was more distant. The man looked at Rezkin and said, Our family has not ruled Ferel for so long by chance. Our power sustains us, as it will you. I know you do not intend to stay. You must name a regent, and then take me to my daughter. The sword, said Rezkin. Yes, yes, you shall have the sword, but you already know where it is. Rezkin tilted his head and realized that he did know where it was. In fact, he knew much about the castle, its power, and the history of the royal family that he had not previously known. Moldovan nodded knowingly and said, Esyojo is a legacy, one carried within the king, transferred via the scepter, amulet, and incantation. Now none but you can wield the enchantments of this stronghold. Rezkin turned to his companions, examining each of them. All were bloody, but most of the blood did not appear to be theirs. Mage Threl looked fatigued. He had seen her watching the impromptu ceremony closely, and he hoped she would be able to explain whatever had just happened. Beyond them, the courtiers clung to each other. While their cries had diminished, their fear persisted as they stood amongst the corpses of their fallen peers. Why you fool? Rezkin said, turning his attention back to his companions. Mage Threl glanced at the others, who did not readily answer. Farson was busy surveying the room. Brant appeared apathetic, and Coledon naturally deferred to the female. She said,
Coledon speaks, Ferelli. You needed a mage, but Journeyman Weston was not ready, and he's keeping the prisoners in check. After him, my talent is most suited for battle.
She glanced at her uncle.
The strikers agree that you would prefer Shazar to remain in charge of the ships, and my uncle thinks he needs to follow me everywhere besides.
Rezkin glanced at Brant. He shrugged and said,
I was bored.
Rezkin descended the dais. He looked at Coledon and said, Kneel. Coledon did so, and Rezkin laid the black blade, still steeped in Ferelli blood, on top of the man's head. He said, Coledon Anshi, I name you King Regent. Stand and claim your scepter. Coledon blinked up at him in surprise and then stood on shaky legs. He slowly grasped the scepter and looked back at Rezkin.
Why me?
Rezkin said, For one, because you are willing to ask that question. Also, you speak several languages, including Ferelli. As the former trade master of your sister's house, you have valuable experience. Mostly, though, because you are here. Moldovan barked a laugh and spoke in Ashayan, as the others had.
An Esyojo with so much power that it passes around kingships like they were water.
Rezkin returned to the dais and faced his grandfather. It is not because I have power, but because people continually insist on inflicting it upon me when I do not desire it. Moldovan took Rezkin's hand in his own, and Rezkin allowed it, since it was unlikely the former king would attack him at that point. Moldovan held both of their hands side by side and said,
Look, yours is strong. Mine is frail. Some would say it is from age, but I know it is because I bled my strength into this kingdom for nearly 8 decades. I have governed with an iron fist, yet few have celebrated my rule. Most no longer hide their whispers that I have lived too long. In you, people find strength and courage. People wish to be a part of something great, even when they cannot find it in themselves. You are their greatness.
Moldovan dropped their hands and reached for the arm of one of the royal guardsmen. He said,
I will retire to my bed until you are ready to leave. Remember your promise. I will see my daughter again.
Rezkin turned to the disconsolate spectators and said, Court is dismissed. In a unified cry of relief, they ran as one toward the throne room door, some tripping over bodies or slipping in gore. Rezkin then looked at the seneschal and Commander Tynan. You two will assist your king regent in learning his duties. He turned to Kolodon and said,
Rule as I would rule.
Kolodon shook his head.
I have been in your company only weeks. I cannot say how you would rule.
Fairly, said Rezkin. Come, I have something to show you. They followed Rezkin, flanked by royal guards, down several flights of stairs to a set of large wooden doors carved with runes. The guards stopped several paces from the doors and stood at attention along the walls on either side. Rezkin motioned for Kolodon to step forward.
Press the scepter against this, he said,
pointing at a rune that looked like a disembodied eye. Kolodon did as he had asked, and the scepter and eye glowed red for a brief moment. Rezkin pressed his palm to the door, causing it to swing inward. He led the group into a dark cave. The floor was covered in water, a lake within the bowels of the castle. As Rezkin stepped into the cavernous room, red lights flared in two lines down the center, and they could see that a stone pathway lay just under the surface between them. As they walked down the pathway, varying colors of light began to shine from beneath its glassy surface. Colorful lights and shadows danced across the natural ceiling and walls of the cave, and specks of glowing dust began to twinkle in their midst. Mage Threl whispered into the dark,
I would never have expected a place so wondrous in this terrifying castle.
This place is old, said Rezkin, older than the castle, older than Pharrell.
He stepped onto a small platform in the center. It was just large enough to hold the four of them a few inches above the water. The lights along the pathway winked out, and they were left surrounded by a glowing lake. Rezkin pointed to a groove in the floor and said,
Place the scepter there.
Once the scepter was in position, the surface of the lake began to shimmer. There, in the water before them, appeared a map. It was not drawn or painted, but rather an exact image of the city. Rezkin turned the scepter, and the image shifted to show a different place. He brushed his fingers across the crystal at the top of the scepter, and it was as if they were standing in the town, staring down the street. They could see the people moving about. A little girl pointed to an enchanted butterfly made of cloth. A stray dog grabbed a biscuit from a merchant's stall, and a woman snagged her coat on a broken cart.
Rezkin said to Kolodon, You may use this to watch over the city.
He pointed to a number of other grooves in the floor.
You will find images of other cities in those.
This is fascinating, said Mage Threl. I've never heard of anything like it. I could spend the entirety of my life studying this.
Mages have, said Rezkin. Only a few are permitted the knowledge to use it. No one knows how the lake works. They know only how to use it. They create new orbs to spread in other cities, but none have been able to reproduce the lake itself. I believe this predates man. It is a remnant of Yanan.
How do you know so much about it?
Rezkin furrowed his brow and stared at the water.
It is as if the ceremony awoke something in me, a memory that is not my own. I know things now that I did not before, but it is as if I have always known them.
Spells do not usually affect you, said Farson.
It was not Moldovan's power. He only activated it. This is much older.
Rezkin peered into the dark water that was intermittently painted with swirling light. He pulled the dark tidings mask from the tie at his belt and secured it over his face.
"What are you doing?"
said Mage Threl.
"You are not going in there. You just said that it holds ancient power that can affect you."
Rezkin glanced her way and then stepped off the platform. His stomach met his throat as he instantly plummeted to the bottom, as if falling through air to collide with the ground. Before he struck in what was sure to be a deadly crunch, a liquid blanket wrapped around him, slowing his descent. He breathed deeply through the mask as he slowed to a stop, and the aqueous fabric held him aloft while he searched for the bottom. His boot touched the hard rock, and the fluid grip released him. Rezkin studied himself and looked around in the darkness. Lights swirled in the distance and sometimes closer. He could feel the water surrounding him, dampening his movements, but he trod over the rock floor as if held down by a weight. As he searched for the sword, he took care to avoid the light. In those dark waters amongst the lights, it began to feel as if he were in a dream. It was reminiscent of the meditative trance he entered in lieu of sleep. After minutes or hours he no longer knew, he began to hear music. As the music grew louder, more light surrounded him. He spun, looking all around, and found no way to avoid them. They closed in on him until he was immersed in light. Rezkin began to feel calm, the same soothing tranquility that inundated him at Kylerum. His persistent hunger began to subside, and the ache of fatigue was vanquished, replaced by a clarity he had not realized had been missing. The small Kaelian stone around his neck heated, but Rezkin was captivated by a figure in the water. At first, he thought it was distant, a vague outline of a person moving toward him. Then it reached out and touched his face, and he realized the being was much closer. The watery figures began to take shape, some of them appearing feminine, while others were masculine. Nixies, he thought. They surrounded him, perhaps by the dozens. They chittered like ripples in a creek. It sounded like laughter. They stroked his face and hair and tugged at his mask. Then they began to pull in earnest. His arms were wrenched behind him, and they swept his feet from beneath him. Tackling him to the ground, they snapped his head back and forth as they pulled at the mask. Rezkin kicked and twisted as he struggled against the insubstantial beings. The stone around his neck began to radiate heat. One of the Nixies reached for it and pulled back with a shriek. The water was suddenly filled with tiny bubbles, and the Nixies backed away. They kept their distance and watched the bubbles pensively. Rezkin scrambled to his feet and stood in the center, knowing he had no strength or power to fight them. The song changed, and the bubbles began to take on a shape of their own. A woman's figure shimmered in the water where the lights bounced off the spherical surfaces of the bubbles that composed her. She reached for Rezkin's mask but did not touch it. She tilted her head and reached again. Then the bubbles shifted to produce a new form, one with whom he was familiar. It was a tree-like creature with feather-tipped twigs atop its head. The bubble form shifted again to resemble a sword, but not the sword of Eiri. It was Kingslayer. The form shifted again to resemble the woman. Rezkin remembered what Bilior had told him about the other ancients. He was in the water, but this creature was made of air. He said, "Hevelia?" The sound escaped the mask in a globule of bubbles. The being tilted her head and then reached for the mask again. Rezkin's heart raced as he grasped its edge. Even if this was truly the Ancient of Wind, there was no guarantee she would be amicable. There was a chance that Bilior had been lying about their deal. Rezkin took a deep breath and then pulled the mask away. A stream of bubbles instantly covered his face. He secured the mask to his belt by feel, and when his vision cleared, Rezkin was astonished. There, in the depths of a black lake in a dark cave, was an entire underwater world he had not been able to see through the enchantments on the mask. The Nixies appeared more substantial, with individual features and expressions. Many of them jumped in excitement and cheered as they clapped each other on the back and hugged in celebration of some achievement. Creatures Rezkin had never seen nor heard tell of. Some larger than a horse swam past, some disappearing into the branching caves. Rezkin finally inhaled, his mouth filling with bubbles. They abruptly coalesced and filled his airway and lungs. It was a strange sensation, but he was glad to not be drowning. Then he saw her. Swimming toward him was not some insubstantial